get in touch with God.
Get in touch with God.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Listening to the Gorilla.
Oh, we're going to let Grandpa Jones be a bit in the background while I tell you what's coming on Toss Salad today, which is a great deal of things. I'm glad to be back, though I was glad to be in the Okanagan as well. And some people have said that I brought snow back with me. There's a lot of snow there. There was plenty to share. So, yes, I did. Mm-hmm. Actually, the snow that you so much enjoyed wherever you were, and please tell me you did enjoy it, that all came courtesy of Emmy Lou and Tammy Joe and me from the Okanagan. But I'm dawdling. Today's show begins with Sam Gibney, executive director of the Port of Port Townsend and former butcherer of turkeys with me, but we'll talk about that. Not on the air today. Rex Rice, music of the trombone until 2 o'clock. In the middle of all that, though, Jan Burr and one of her colleagues in this project, Dance in Solidarity Against Fear, Racism, and Misogyny. They will be here about 1:15 to talk about the event rather briefly, but still, you need to know about these things. Tom Jay with a word and a poem at 2. Billy Zoom, remember Billy Zoom from Saturday mornings? Well, he comes in from time to time to be a guest DJ because I invite him and he likes to be here. Kate Dean, County Commissioner, and Annie Benson, two people to talk about sanctuary cities, welcoming cities. I have a brief conversation with them, and then Don White will read Victory, a short story by Simon Rich. This is Tossed Salad. I am Phil Andrus. I am looking at Sam Gibney and saying welcome.
Thank you, Phil. Well, nice. Good to see you.
And I'm welcome, too, aren't
you? It's a welcoming city.
Yeah. Hey, at least. And maybe we need to seek sanctuary in this little room here. Okay, you are executive director of the Port of Port Townsend.
That is correct.
And you have been for how long?
I started there June 8th, 2016.
And you were hired for a quick process, and a number of people involved with the port intervened on your behalf. One of our best buddies, actually, who has a mailing list a mile long, twisted a lot of made it so that the three port commissioners' arms were well twisted because you had a lot of support from your time in the community.
Is that right? I didn't know about so much of the arm twisting. I knew that they received a lot of calls and emails, and I think I'm fortunate to have a history here being in the community. I lived here for 20 years before I went up to the San Juan Islands, and so I've had the good fortune of making lots of deep friendships and knowing people like you.
And you, I believe, began your life on a farm in Iowa.
Ohio.
One of those states back there, one of those red states back there. But we don't need to worry about
flat
that.
Flat states, yes.
Mm-hmm. Farm girl from Ohio finds herself in Port Townsend as executive director of a port district in between.
What went on
in your life?
Who would have thunk that? Yes, I did start out in Ohio and did my bachelor's degree in San Diego. Promptly left there and went and lived in Alaska for a few years. Worked up there and then had some friends that were living in Chimicum. And I regularly traveled on business, and I would stop in Seattle, and I'd often break my ticket and come over and visit with them, and just really fell in love with the place. And after a few years in Alaska, decided I wanted to come down here.
And your training is as a civil engineer?
I have a bachelor's degree in civil engineering and a master's in public administration.
And I knew you first. Well, actually, I knew you first in the Phil Johnson campaign. His first time round, we met in your office, and then you were working as an engineer, but not so much with slide rules. It seemed like you were doing a lot of planning at that time.
That is correct. My career progressed from, I started out really doing, in Alaska, doing CERCLA planning, which stands for the Superfund site. People often know that. It's cleaning up contaminated sites, so it's an environmental engineering. Started with that. Then came down here and really worked a lot in surface water and coastal restoration. And as I worked in that, I kind of moved my career, my practice more towards the beginnings of the project, kind of kept walking where I would participate back and back until where I was scoping things, really developing the how a project would move forward, how you would fund it, how you would get it permitted. And that eventually led me to my to seek a master's degree in that as well.
In public policy?
In public administration and policy, yes.
Uh-huh. Did it surprise you when the notion of doing such a thing really started to press upon you? I mean, that's a change from being an engineer, I think.
I don't think it's as much as a change as one might imagine, because really, particularly the type of civil engineering that I've always been involved with, I've always done a lot of public projects. So that how do you take a policy or a regulation, how do you then work in the physical environment towards that, and then how do you actually get it funded, get it constructed, and manage the project towards a good outcome? So I've been doing that for quite some time. But the taking it to a little bit more broader arena of how do you really involve stakeholder groups, constituencies, how do you look at things so that you are developing a real public value on the projects that you're doing? You know, so just kind of, to me, it's been more of an evolution and a broadening of my scope than a grand departure.
You know what I thought you were going to do?
What?
I thought you were going to be the next District 1 County Commissioner. That was what I thought you were looking towards when we first worked on Phil Johnson's campaign. Well, someone else has come along who we well support. But, you know, I thought, and I still can see you in elected office, in fact.
Yes, and Kate Dean is also we're fellow alumni of the Evans School of Public Affairs and Policy at the University of Washington. So we have that in common, and I think I'm excited to have her in that office. I think she brings a perspective that's both based in her time here in the community, working as an entrepreneur, raising children here, as well as this really rigorous practice of public policy and how do we deliver public
and
value.
And your time may yet come.
Possibly.
Okay, we'll
see.
Will not try to pin you down on that one. You find yourself, at any rate now, at the helm of the Port of Port Townsend.
That is correct.
And we who read the newspaper, or we who have worked in the port, as I have, not for the port, but in the port, had a boat in the marina since 1985, pay attention to the port, know that the port has some serious, serious infrastructure problems, had actually some serious organizational problems. You might have known about the latter, but how well aware were you of the former, that is, the impending doom of some of the very important structures upon which the Port of Port Townsend depends? I'm talking about two breakwaters.
When I first learned that the job was available and was considering applying for it, I certainly did some research, and so I knew to some extent. I will tell you that the full breadth of the uphill climb that we face, I was probably not really aware of it. But as in so many other things in life, if I really knew, I probably wouldn't have done it. And you know, so but now I do know, and it's, you know, one step at a time.
Okay, and I did mention the breakwaters.
Yes.
Why do you think things were allowed to get to the state that they have? And there are people on staff. I know these people on staff, know quite a few of the people on staff, actually, who did know. But somehow, either the information was not taken to the top, which is to say the previous director and the commissioners, or they chose to pay not sufficient attention.
Well, I always like to remind people that the Port of Port Townsend is not unique in where we find ourselves as a local government and facing the infrastructure challenges that we do. There are, of course, there's part of our own story that is, you know, all this, the facts that go along with that. But the larger story is that, you know, since the 1950s, we have seen, you know, a great shift at both the national level and at the state level of investment in infrastructure. And I like to tell people
For example,
you know, I remain a member of the American Society of Civil Engineers, and that is an organization that gives our nation a D- in our infrastructure investment and maintenance.
How many bridges? Do you know the number of bridges now currently deemed to be inadequate?
Thousands and thousands. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The one thing I will tell you is that on average, there's a one bridge collapse a day across the United States. Now, some of those are, you know, small crossings, maybe one lane. Some of them are absolutely spectacular, like we saw in Minnesota. So, you know, our infrastructure is aging. We as a country have not kept up with the continual investments in both maintenance but also replacement, because a lot of these things were built as part of programs in investment during one of our last economic downturns. And so they're coming to the end of their service life. And as we get to that, the cost to be able to actually repair them becomes more and more expensive. It's very similar to healthcare costs. You know, you can spend a small amount over years and maintain things, maintain your health. But as you get towards the end, the costs just go exponential.
What I have said to people in that regard, not healthcare so much, although perhaps it could be applied there as well, is that we have mined the infrastructure that our parents and grandparents built for us. Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't build it for us. They built it for them as well. Mm-hmm. They built it for the common good. But we've mined it. That is, we have treated it as mm-hmm. one would a mineral mm-hmm. resource, something that can be used up and does not need to be sustained.
That I think, is an appropriate metaphor, analogy, and I harken back to that commercial in my youth where it was the auto mechanic that would say, you can pay me now or you can pay me later, but sooner or later you're going to pay me. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it is, it's something that I think as a nation that we we've really been short-sighted on, and I think that's one of the things that we need to come to grips with. And that's part of the reason why the American Society of Civil Engineers started doing this report card for the nation. And they break them down by state as well. Interestingly,
was the Port of Port Townsend in there?
Not specifically. Uh-huh. I think they, you know, kind of aggregate the data. But interestingly, port infrastructure doesn't typically get rated as poorly. And that's because they're, you know, when you look at the port industry as a whole and you see the investments that go into like Tacoma and Seattle or Long Beach, you know, that kind of brings that up. But particularly these smaller jurisdictions and the local jurisdictions, we've seen that diminishment in with federal dollars, but also with state dollars. And so, you know, what we'll take the breakwater at the Boat Haven, the newer portion, that is the portion that's not directly adjacent to the commercial basin, that was installed by the Corps of Engineers in the 1960s. They had a program. They did installations like that. They had, you know, some maintenance obligations that they took on with that. Now in 2017, they basically look at us and say, there's no way we're getting to you. You are so far down on our list that there's no way that we would be able to help you replace this. We might be able to do some repair if there were some things like that, but beyond that, there are places that are in a lot worse shape than you are.
What does that say about not just the, well, actually, the you're not big enough reminds me of Earl Butz. Remember him? Secretary of Agriculture, I believe, under Lyndon Johnson, mm-hmm. get bigger, get out.
Uh-huh,
so
uh-huh.
we're not big, and maybe mm-hmm. that's part of it. But don't you think also that what you're describing in a larger sense describes a fairly mm-hmm. significant change in society and societal values?
Absolutely. You know, I was on a phone call recently with Congressman Derek Kilmer, as well with other administrators from around the Olympic Peninsula, and Kate Dean was on that call. And Derek Kilmer was looking at the possibility that this new federal administration might follow through with a infrastructure package of some kind. And what was being discussed was using tools such as tax credits or low-interest loans. Pretty much uniformly on the call, and there's probably 15 managers or so on there, went, that does us no good. You know, we do not have the type of densities and the size of user groups to ever make that possible. I mean, what would we do? Put a toll road on 101? And so as we discussed that, one of the things I brought up, I said, you know, what we're all feeling here is what I believe is this kind of a shift in the social contract between the more dense urban areas and the rural landscape that surrounds them. And that's shifted in a lot of different ways, everything from how our food systems work to, you know, how we plan for infrastructure, everything from schools to medical care to our roads to phone companies, you know. That has shifted dramatically in the last 50 to 60 years. You know, it used to be that if a utility, such as a phone company, was given the market to be able to have, you know, you get this dense urban market, you get to make a profit there, but you also have to then service the surrounding rural countryside at the same level. And so you can't just pick off the really profitable parts. And that very concept has, in my opinion, has shifted dramatically.
And those of us who attempt to, I don't know what the noise in the background is, by the way, but it's ornery, a siren or something. Those of us who live in the rural parts of this county know that internet access, yes, people ask me if I have DSL, and I say, well, sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. The supplier of internet service to most of the rural parts of this county, the owner of the naming rights to a football stadium in Seattle, certainly must concentrate more on their Seattle customers than folks out here. But let's get to the port again some more. In order to have a secure future, what does the port need to do with respect to both organization and the rocks, you know, the hard stuff, the buildings, the infrastructure.
Right, and I think it's those two things combined that we really need to be focusing on. And so what I've been discussing with the commission and my staff and a lot of people who are avid port followers is that we need to make sure that we have not only an operational plan and a good, you know, business plan of where we're moving, but a capital plan that goes with that. So in our budget this year, we adopted a operating budget. We also adopted the list of a capital budget for the capital projects that we're going to accomplish. We then listed out a few more years into the future. These are the projects that we can see coming. And so that's one of the things I'm introducing into the organization, that ability to project forward. Typically do that in a six-year time frame. It kind of coincides with other county planning, the thing. But we can look forward and we can kind of see things coming. We can start to plan for them, everything from how we're going to get them permitted, but very especially how we're going to get them funded. So, and really putting a robust mechanism in place for that. So we're not surprised by projects when they come up.
It takes some discipline then, doesn't it, too, to concentrate on the things that really matter?
It does. Discipline and strategy. You always come back to strategy of, you know, how are you strategically moving things forward?
So what needs to be fixed, not organizationally, but back to the physical items that the port...
The
breakwaters and other things as well. The airport, I guess, needs work for some reason or other.
Big ones that we're working on right now is we are under an administrative order from the Department of Ecology for our stormwater system. And so we are looking at options to come into compliance with that. We hired a consultant, and the original price came back at about $1.2 to $1.8 million to install a system.
Is that a lot of money?
That's a lot of money for an organization of our size, to kind of put that into context.
And since we're going to talk about these items one by one, which is good, I will ask you one by one, where is that 1.6 to 1.8, I believe, million you said, where does it come from?
Great question. I mean, so 1.2 to 1.8 million dollars. Our yard operations, which this stormwater system would really be in service of the yard operations, typically grosses about $1.7 million a year in revenue, and that's gross.
Yeah.
So, you know, my first blush when we got this report back was to, whoa, this is out of sync with our revenues. It's also, I felt, was really out of sync with the size of our operation. The design came back, and the facility that we would have built would have been about 5.5 feet tall on average, 20 feet wide, and 1,000 feet long. So that's a huge structure.
What would it do?
It would have been a bioinfiltration structure. So it would have sand and other media in it, and as well as some plants planted on top. And so the plan was to install a pump station at our marine discharge, in our which is actually in the marina, to pump back up to this and then trickle it out over this infiltration gallery. And I'm not saying that it was a bad plan. I think it probably would be an effective plan. I think that it was out of scale, both in its cost and also in its size. So what we did is to apply the principles of value engineering at that point and really look at, you know, what could we do different, how could we approach this problem differently. And as I kind of talk, I keep walking the problem back. And so we have come up with a proposal that we're just getting ready to put together now that we'll be sending into Department of Ecology. That'll be a fraction of that cost for upfront investment. It will obligate us to some ongoing operation and maintenance. That's going to be with either one of them. But we're also looking to do some other planning for the boatyard. And so we're seeking some funding to look at the source of our contaminated soils that might be on the property, and look how we might shift operations in a way that would really much more fundamentally address the impact of some of our operations, like sanding and grinding on boats. And, you know, do we need to put them inside? Do we need to get rub shelters, et cetera?
And I was, as you may recall, my work has been marine wiring.
Mm-hmm.
And though I was under the impression I was retired, I guess I'm going to do a little job in a couple of weeks. So I guess I don't just guess. I know that I'm going to. Mm-hmm. By the way, I'm talking to Sam Gibney, who's the mm-hmm. executive director of the Port of Port Townsend. Mm-hmm. So I was down in the boatyard yesterday. And there was a time 15 mm-hmm. years ago or 20 when the travel lift mm-hmm. operators struggled mm-hmm. to find places to put the boats they hauled out.
Mm-hmm.
That boatyard is empty.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
Yeah.
And what can you do about that?
Yeah.
Because that would, the revenue that that the port is not getting from the boats that used to be there that aren't there anymore, that'd be pretty helpful, wouldn't it?
It would be helpful, and it is something that we're looking at, and looking at both short-term and long-term of what to do. And it's one of the things, trust me, my commissioners ask me regularly.
Same question.
About the same question. And mm-hmm. and some of it, I think, is, the fishermen had a really tough year this year. And so kind of the hypothesis is that they'll wait till later in the year to do some minimum maintenance. So there's some larger market trends at play here. There are also some, you know, when we've seen this big change in administration, we had both not only the executive director but the deputy director leave, and so we had two positions that needed to be filled. But we're also kind of hitting the pause button ever so slightly, and we're not stopping things. But one of the things I think, because I bring this engineering background in, is I really wanted to get a good handle on where things are in the yard, where our utilities are, where the stormwater system is, and take a little bit more systematic approach to planning long term. And so while I know people are nervous because there are some pretty big open spaces in our yard at this point, I want to assure them that we're doing the planning so that we can really build a foundation so that we can up the and get back to some pretty dense activity and be prepared for that. And in order to be prepared for that, we need to be able to do things like, you know, install some new electrical outlets. So, for example, we already have some vendors that want to come in and they need 483 phase. So we need to be able to plan for that. We need to be able to get it in. The other thing also, like, I have spent I and staff and has spent a good deal of our attention on addressing this stormwater issue, and that becomes an order of magnitude. Of, you know, if I can reduce the cost of that stormwater infrastructure, you know, very, very aggressively, then what we're not necessarily seeing in revenue in the small boat yard, you know, we'll be replacing that. We will be saving the organization overall by reducing the cost of that stormwater infrastructure. So there's some kind of strategic decisions that we're making of where do we place our attention right now.
So does that mean Fewer small boats hauled out? Does that mean less attention to smaller boats and a concentration on the larger ones?
No, I wouldn't say that we're at that point in deciding on strategy. I think it's just a matter of where do we have the capacity to really market right now. We'll be looking to, and part of we're at a seasonal, ebb and flow. And
this is the time that the boatyard should be full, not the time that it should be empty. Let's hate to cut that one off, but let's talk about Point Hudson, because the matter of the breakwater and the general overall condition of everything at Point Hudson, buildings and the breakwater, have gotten a good bit of attention, as well they should. And there's talk about collaboration between or among various entities, the city, the Maritime Center, and the Port of Port Townsend, perhaps others as well.
Yes.
All those entities have a great deal of interest in Point Hudson, but what can they do together, especially, it's always a matter, in part, of money.
Yes. I will tell you that when I first took the job, I came down to overlap with Larry Crockett on his way out, and he took me around to show me some facilities, and we went down there, and I'd been down there many times. It'd been, several years since I'd been out onto the walkway. And I had done my homework and knew that the jetty was failing and needed replacement. So we started walking out there, and I stopped dead in my tracks. And Larry kept walking, and I called out to him and said, "Larry, I am seeing a whole lot of void space in this jetty." And he kind of waved over his shoulder and said, "It's your problem now." And as I went out there and peered over and looked at the condition of the pilings and the wire and things that are holding together and the tilt of the walkway, I distinctly remember turning around and looking back at Port Townsend and just really being hit with this notion that, oh, this isn't just a port problem. This is a community issue, and that we have a lot of people that have invested life energy, money, resources, time into really bolstering our maritime heritage and the economy that surrounds that, thinking how important Port Hudson is to downtown Port Townsend, how important it is to locals that just like to come down and take a walk on the beach and go to the restaurants. So it really struck me that this was something that belonged to the community, and the issue belongs to the community as well. And I think both my orientation as well as some other key leaders such as David Timmons from the city and Jake Beattie from the Maritime Center have that orientation as well. So we've started that conversation. We've applied for some grant monies to start a planning process with working with our potential partners, the stakeholders, such as these organizations, our tenants, and the community at large.
So I don't see the Maritime Center as having very deep pockets, but I see the City of Port Townsend potentially as having the deepest pockets of the three entities. Isn't it reasonable to consider, to ask even, the City of Port Townsend to help out financially, not out of their operating budget perhaps, but out of their ability to raise funds, not just grant funds, but other means as well?
I think the first thing you do is you invite them into the conversation, and that's already started. And so, the administrators have already been talking. We've had some informal meetings with the mayor and the chair of our commission. And, as we then embark upon this planning process, we'll be having more formal meetings between, let's say, the Port Commission and the City Council. So I think the first thing, we would get everyone engaged. We understand the magnitude of the issue and really kind of the scope of the issue. And then you start looking at what various people can bring to the table. I think kind of come out of the gate and say, "Hey, you want to write us a check?" That's probably not going to be too effective.
But nevertheless, it is a consideration, and everybody knows that.
I think.
Don't you think everybody knows that?
I think everybody knows that we all have a stake in the outcome here.
And it takes money sometimes to what part of being a stakeholder is about.
Yeah, and as I remind my commission on a regular basis, that partnership comes in many different forms. It's not always in a form of writing a check or bringing dollars to the table. Sometimes it's providing access to those. Sometimes it is looking at a different way that you can do things. I think the Maritime Center is, you know, one of the things that they've expressed is they would have access to some private philanthropic funds that we as a public agency would not. So, you know, I don't know how all of this is going to turn out. I think one of the things I've really tried to do is to not get too far ahead of myself in this. And I specifically don't think about a lot of physically what might change at Point Hudson, because I want to keep a really open mind to other people's ideas. So I really try not to think about that part.
To make another point, to make Point Hudson strong, mm-hmm. to make it strong for the next generation, we'll say, that mm-hmm. means fixing the breakwater. Mm-hmm. It means a bunch of other things as well.
Yes.
What do you think the price tag would be?
I did a little exercise. I took the cost of the breakwater, which is now estimated at $5.5 million. Some estimating that we've done on some just very basic, let's keep the place from falling in on itself, like replacing roofs, not taking out asbestos pipes, not really even renovating to bring things up to a commercial grade, but let's just keep the buildings from falling apart.
But also keep the character of the place as it is, more or less.
In this kind of back of the envelope exercise that I went through is definitely not changing or adding any additional buildings, anything. Just what it would cost to literally keep the roofs from falling in. Kind of added that up, subtracted out that right now we have about $1.1 million in grant funding. Subtracted that, took the balance and said, okay, I had to go to the bond market and amortize this over 20 years, what would we need to net from the property in order to service this debt? And between $500,000 and $600,000 a year annually.
And presently, you don't net. You net something in the red, negative net, right?
We net somewhere right around zero. It's usually in the red. Sometimes it's a little above.
That should be a surprise. It was a surprise to me, I guess, because it's mm-hmm. such a wonderful piece of property mm-hmm. that in fact, the port can't make money on it in its present configuration. But apparently, what changes would need to be made then?
I think the biggest changes that we need is to, again, have this matching up of our operating budgets and our capital budgets, so that those two things are talking to each other and very supportive of one another. So just having that analysis and knowing what repairs are necessary, I think is the first step. I think, you know, beyond that, it's, you know, I'm not sure what the solution is.
Because you need more revenue.
We do need more revenue, yes. Now, I will say that there's other ways that you can come at the problem as well. And this is where I again go back to partnerships of it could be that, you know, so the more that you lower the cost of kind of the internal cost of capital to the port or us as a group, and be it in the form of additional grants, and we are looking at some additional grants, and we do think that there are some available, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $600,000. That does not get us to $5.5 million. But are there other long-term strategies that we can be looking to the state for a specific capital request? Can we be looking for other appropriations? Are there philanthropic organizations that might be interested in the property as a whole and its place in our maritime heritage? So you start looking at how do you drop that cost to the capital input that has to come kind of out of our revenue generating side.
Sam Gibney, I have to tell you that sometimes I don't listen carefully enough to the answers, so I don't know whether you gave me a price tag for Point Hudson or not.
In total?
Yeah, in total, please. Ballpark.
I don't know if I'm going to ballpark it. I mean, honestly, I think that some of the things that happened.
$10 million, $20 million.
I, you know, you're really going to press me on
this.
Well,
I'm curious. I really am.
I'd say probably we're looking at least $10 million,
uh-huh.
and that's really just to kind of, you know, make sure we have the roads that work. We make mm-hmm. sure we have the water lines, that we have buildings that we can actually rent for a commercial rate.
I'm helping you with your planning, you see.
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
In the first year of our son's life, my son's life, mm-hmm. not you and me, but Amy Lou and I, we bought a boat. the 26-foot sailboat, we put it in the port. And a couple of years after that, our daughter was born. Family of four at that time, we got a bigger boat. We've had that one since 1990. Cruising on the boat, sailing on the boat, crabbing, fishing on the boat were the way that our kids were brought up. Were we to start over again somehow, magically, in the year 2017, we couldn't do that because we couldn't afford to keep a boat in the marina. Or if we could, it would be really difficult. I understand the need, especially in these times, with so much maintenance having been deferred for so long, the need for additional revenue. But do you, do the commissioners, consider the social cost of making water access to families so difficult? I say families, not rich folks who some people think are the folks who have boats in the marina, but in fact, a lot of families. Do you consider the social costs? And if you do, how do you address them?
We absolutely consider those costs, and in fact, we're guided by our strategic plan, which has a number of different values that we address in our decision making. Providing access to the water is one of those, and I would say that there, that phenomena of the affordability for any one family to afford to be able to keep a boat in the marina happens in a much larger context than the budget of the Port of Port Townsend. That happens in a economy where wage growth has been very flat for when you adjust for inflation. The cost of real estate has accelerated. The cost of a lot of our other day-to-day things are happening. So our average disposable income has shifted. You know, so there are a lot of phenomena that factor into what is affordable. In even considering that, there are things that we have done, like designing the A and B dock to make sure that it had some smaller slips so that it boats of 25, 27 feet could be kept in the marina. We've invested in the increasing the boat ramp. That's also a market trend that is very much at play here. Boat ownership has shifted dramatically in Washington State, but really across the nation. The vast majority of new boat sales are trailerable boats, so people get access to the water with having a trailerable boat. They also get access to the water with kayak launches, being able to walk on the beach, et cetera. So there are a number of different things of, like, how do we provide access to the water. All that being said, I understand that this cost, this increasing in cost is very real and may indeed affect individuals' decision of whether or not they can afford to keep a boat. And that's, again, we look to this very large shift in how people are approaching recreation in their lives, and we see this from the data, particularly with the millennials, as they're called, is that, there's the notion that they are going to own a boat individually and have that be for their family is not really a common concept. They're much more interested in, how do I have access to a boat? How do I share that boat? How do I, get to have the experience, even if it's an ongoing experience, of being on the water, but I don't want to do that just by myself. And that's both financial, but I think it's also a real orientation to this kind of larger notion of the sharing economy that we have.
Sounds like rates are going up.
The commission just
drastically, perhaps.
And the commission just adopted a rate increase that will become effective April 1st.
Percentage?
Percentages varied, though I like to talk in terms of real dollars. Think so. The increase for a 30-foot boat, I believe, don't totally quote me on this, is about $35 a month.
You think that will be annual from now until whenever?
I think I'm very aware that we can't have these type of rate adjustments very regularly or, of this magnitude. We will price ourselves out of the market, be it local or otherwise, and that the marina can't sustain these type of increases long term.
So the assumption that the rates could go skyward and people would continue to want to rent space in the marina is questionable.
Oh, it has its limits, absolutely. I think, you know, at the, you know, both the micro and macroeconomic, you know, there is a crossover between supply and demand and the pricing, you know, that goes along with that.
Yeah, but as you continue to move people, local people, out of the marina, and people from the I-5 corridor come here, they do have more disposable income.
That's an interesting notion. A lot of people bring that up, that somehow price movement equates to less local people being in the marina, and I'm not quite sure where that comes from, because I don't really see a lot of data to support that notion.
Probably nobody's brought it together. I know from my working days in the marina, I could tell when my customers were from the other side of the water, that they didn't seem to me to have less of a concern for the cost of things than especially the local fishermen. One more question. We're out of time, Sam.
Are we already?
Well, look at the clock.
That went fast. You know,
we're over time. So I didn't budget the time so well, but I'm thinking that we ought to do this maybe on a quarterly basis.
And be happy to.
I think we should do that.
Okay.
Sam Gibney, thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a good time. It's almost as much fun as butchering turkeys, isn't it?
Almost, but, you know, that was a special day.
I will let you go now and have a good afternoon.
Thanks.
Sam Gibney, the executive director of the Port of Port Townsend. This is Toss Salad. I'm Phil Andrus. Pretty soon here we're going to have music of the trombone with Rex Rice. In the meantime, which will be a short meantime while we trade seats in this control room, we'll listen to some music of Stepan Crapelli.